of body and soul. If we consider not the details, but the general bearing of the bad relations between Joseph and his brothers as they grew with the years, not the daily vexations and misunderstandings, but the fundamental causes of the trouble, these would be found to lie in envy and in arrogance. The most justice-loving would find it hard to decide which fault, or, personally speaking, which sinner, the single one, or the troop who made ever more threatening their common cause against him, was the chief source of the trouble. Strict justice and the upright desire to put aside any temptation to partisanship might perhaps lead one to consider arrogance as the primary evil and source of mischief, but on the other hand, he will in very justice be driven to confess that not often in the world has there been so much occasion for arrogance, and indeed for envy, as here. It is seldom indeed that beauty and wisdom are combined upon this earth. Rightly or wrongly, we are accustomed to think of learning as ugly, and charm as mindless, and indeed, as is fitting for the possessor of charm, mindless with a good conscience. For what need has charm of letters, mind, or wisdom, when it even runs a risk of being warped and destroyed if it possessed them? The typical bridging over, however, of the gulf between mind and beauty, the union of both excellences in a single being, appears as the release of attention, which one is used to think of as based upon the natural and human, and makes one quite involuntarily think of the divine. The unprejudiced eye must look with rapture upon such a manifestation of godlike ease and absence of strain, while it can only give rise to feelings of bitterness in those who have reason to find themselves injured or eclipsed by its light. So it was here. That delighted acceptance which certain sights find at once in the human heart, and which we are accustomed objectively to call their beauty, was invariable in the case of Rachel's firstborn son. Whether or no we could now subscribe with such enthusiasm, everybody then found him so well favored that his charms early became proverbial over the countryside. And not only so, but they added unto themselves the arts of the intellect, which they absorbed with the greatest readiness, and then recoined, stamped with their own seal, so that there seemed no longer any contradiction, and almost no difference between the two. I said that the harmonizing of the conflict must have seemed to result in the divine, a sentence that needs interpretation. The two elements were not resolved into the divine, for Joseph was a human being, and a very erring one to boot, with far too good an understanding not to recognize the fact. No, but they were resolved in the divine, that is to say, in the moon. I have already described a scene which was very typical of the relations, physical and mental, which Joseph cherished with that wonder-working star. It was behind his father's back, of course, who, as he came up, made haste to rebuke his son for bearing himself in flirtation with the naked splendor there above. But in the youth's mind, the thought of the moon was associated with more than the mere idea of beauty. It had just as close connection with the conception of wisdom and of letters, for the moon was the heavenly image of Tot, the white ape and inventor of signs, the speaker and writer of the gods, recorder of their words and protecting deity of all those who write. Thus, it was the combined magic of beauty and of learning, together and as a unity, which had ravished his soul and given its peculiar meaning to his solitary worship. As a cult, it was vague, confused, and prone to degenerate, calculated to alarm the careful father. But just on that ground, intoxicating, because mental and physical emotions were therein so enchantingly mixed. Beyond a doubt, every human being holds and cherishes, more or less consciously, some conception, some treasured idea, which forms the source of his secret passion, and by which his vital sense of life is nourished and sustained. For Joseph, this precious idea was the cohabitation of body and spirit, beauty and wisdom, and the reciprocally strengthening consciousness of both. Chaldean travelers and slaves had related to him how, when Bel purposed to create mankind, he had had his head cut off, his blood had mingled with the earth, and out of those blood-besprent clods life had been created. He did not believe the tale, but if he wished to feel aware of his own existence and know a mysterious sense of rejoicing in it, he would recall that blood-boltered mingling of the earthy with the divine, and be conscious of peculiar bliss in being of such substance. He would be smilingly mindful that the consciousness of the body and of beauty must be improved and strengthened through the consciousness of the mind and spirit, as well as the other way round. What he believed was that the Spirit of God, whom the people of Shinar called Mumu, brooded upon the face of chaos, and had created the world by the might of the Word. What a marvel, he thought. The world had arisen by the might of the free and external Word. And even today, let a thing be ever so present, it was in actual fact only actually present when man has given it life in words and called it by name. So did his pretty and well-favored little head convince itself of the importance and wisdom of the Word. But all these teachings and tendencies, indulged by Jacob on grounds yet to be mentioned, served only the more to estrange Joseph from the sons of Leah and of the maids. It set him apart, and this in itself bore the seeds of arrogance and mistrust. It goes against my grain to say that the brothers, those first-born males of Jacob's seed, whose names everybody knows by heart, were in the main very ordinary fellows. To two of them, at least, the complicated and suffering Jehuda and the fundamentally decent Reuben, the characterization does scant justice. In the first place, one could not speak of beauty in connection with any of them. Neither of those who were near Joseph's age, nor those who were well on in the 20s at this time. Though they were stout fellows, particularly Leah's brood, and rejoiced in physical strength and agility, most of all Reuben, but also Simeon, Levi, and Jehuda. As for wisdom and the Word, not one among them but would have prided himself on his complete ignorance and contempt of such talents. Bilhah's Naphtali, indeed, was known from his youth up for his gift of the gab. But the popular standards in this matter were modest, and the sum total of Naphtali's powers amounted to a shallow glibness without foundation in any higher things. All the brethren, in short, were, as Joseph too should have been, in order to fit into their society, shepherds and farmers on the side. In both which capacities, of course, they were very much worthwhile, and felt, as was natural, great resentment toward their younger brother, who imagined, with his father's connivance, that he might be farmer and shepherd too, but only incidentally, his real occupations being those of scribe and reader of tablets. Later on they had a name for Joseph which expressed to the full the height of their hatred, the Dreamer of Dreams. But at this time they mockingly called him Noah, Utnapishtim, the Exceeding Wise One, the Reader of Stones from before the Flood. He, on his side, retorted with dog's heads, and people who know not good from evil, calling them these to their faces, protected only by their fear of Jacob, for otherwise they would have beaten him black and blue. That would have been painful to see, yet his beauty must not blind us to the fact that his retort was no better than their mockery. Worse, even, for what use is wisdom if it cannot shield us from the sin of arrogance? But Jacob the father, how did he stand to all this? He was not a scholar. Of course, in addition to his South Canaanitish dialect, he spoke Babylonian, perhaps even better. But he had no Egyptian, probably because, as we have seen, he mistrusted and condemned everything that came from that country. It stood to him as the home of immorality and feudal abuse. The service of the state, which obviously conditioned all things in that country, offended his hereditary sense of independence and personal responsibility, while the cult of animals and of the dead which flourished there was to him folly and abomination, the latter even more than the former. For all that worship of the under-earth, which began even with the earth, even with the seed-corn which fruitfully rotted therein, was to him synonymous with lewdness. He called the land of mud down there not kempt, or Mizraim, but Sheol, hell, the kingdom of the dead. His disgust, on grounds both ethical and intellectual, extended to the exaggerated respect which, as he had heard, was paid there to letters. He personally could not do much more in that line than sign his name to contracts, and even so he mostly stamped it. All the rest he left to Eliezer, his eldest servant, and was justified in so doing, for the skill of our servants is as our own, and in any case Jacob's weight and dignity rested not upon such, being essentially personal, native, and freely arising. They were based upon the power of his feeling and experience, upon a fullness of shrewd and significant anecdote, upon the natural spirituality which radiated from him and was perceptible to everybody, upon the preponderant personality of a gifted man who dreamed bold dreams and had immediate relations with God. A man, in short, who need not trouble about book knowledge. It would be idle to compare Jacob with Eliezer. Certainly the idea of doing so would never have occurred to the latter. But after all, would Eliezer ever have dreamed the dream of the latter? Or with God's help have made discoveries in the natural kingdom, such as the part played by sympathetic magic in the breeding of the streaked yeanlings? No, never. But then why did Jacob approve of Joseph's education, and look with a favoring eye upon teachings, the danger of which, to the lad and to his relations with his brethren, could not have escaped him? He had two reasons, both of which sprang from his love of Joseph. One of them was ambitious in its nature, the other had to do with his care for the disciplining of the boy's character. Leah, the unloved wife, had of course known whereof she spoke, when she had said to herself and the sons of her body at the time of Joseph's birth that they would now all be as nothing in Jacob's eyes, and light as air. Since the day when the child of the true wife, Dumuzi, the only scion and son of the virgin, had been vouchsafed to him, Jacob had thought of nothing else but to set this latecomer before the early ones, to place him at their head, and make him, who was only Rachel's firstborn, the firstborn of them all. His anger, when Reuben had so forgotten himself with Bilhah, had been real enough, but also ulterior in its nature, and his expression of it somewhat calculated. Joseph had not known, or had only been half conscious, but when in childish malice he had repeated to his father what he had seen, Jacob's first thought had been, "Now I can curse my eldest born, and the place will be free for the little one." But he was conscious of the thought, and also he was afraid of the anger of the sons who came after Reuben. Thus he had not dared to take advantage at once of the opportunity to set Joseph in the ill-doer's room. He held off, waiting and, as it were, keeping warm the place for the little one. For, of course, what we are dealing with here is the blessing of Abraham, which Jacob owned, which he had received in Esau's stead from his blind father, and which now he had in mind to hand on in a way which was not above board, but underhanded. If he could possibly manage it, this great good should be Joseph's, who was quite obviously, both in flesh and in spirit, more fitted to receive it than the heavy-handed and light-headed Reuben. He would clutch at any means to make clear to others, even to the brethren, Joseph's higher gifts, for instance, learning. The times had changed. Up till now, the spiritual heirs of Abraham had not needed this good gift. Jacob himself had not suffered from its lack. But who knew if in the future it might not be, perhaps not necessary, yet useful and desirable, that the bearer of the blessing should also be a scholar and learned. Whether great or small, it was an advantage, and Joseph could never have too much of anything that would set him before the brothers. This was one ground of Jacob's consent. The other lay deeper in the father's careful heart. It had to do with the boy's salvation and religious sanity. We have seen how Jacob, in that scene by the well, had cautiously questioned his son about the coming rainfall, holding, as it were, his hand protectingly over him the while. He had not liked to ask. Only his great need for information on this all-important subject had made him turn to advantage a mood in his son, which nonetheless it disquieted him to see, though he was not without admiration for it. He was aware of Joseph's tendency to states approaching the ecstatic, to half-pretended, undeveloped, but at times genuinely prophetic seizures. His attitude toward these, as a parent, fluctuated, impressed as he was by the equivocal mixture of evil and holiness in such tendencies. The brethren, dear me, none of them showed any faintest sign of belonging to the elect. They did not look in the least like seers or sufferers. One need lose no sleep over them. Ecstasies, whether for good or for evil, were not in their line. It did, in a certain way, fall in with Jacob's hopes that Joseph differed from them in these matters. You could interpret the fact as a distinction, which, along with the others, made the choice a convincing one. Nonetheless, Jacob was not quite at ease over what he had seen. There were people about. God forbid that Joseph should become one of these. Holy innocents, slaverers, possessed of spirits, who earned their bread by foaming at the mouth and delivering prophecies. Human oracles, who went about babbling, or were visited by the inquiring in caves, and earned food and money for jobs of finding lost articles or prophesying lucky days. Jacob, on religious grounds, loved them not at all. But then nobody did, though all took care not to offend them. They were dirty, with crazed and disordered ways. Children ran after them, shouting out, "Aula saula la kaula," in imitation of their babbling. They wounded and mutilated themselves, ate polluted food, went about with a yoke on their necks or a pair of horns on their heads. Sometimes they went naked. That was like them, the horns as well as the nakedness. It was not hard to know the source of their behavior, the filthiness of the worship of Baal, the ritual whoredom, the fertility magic, and orgiastic sacrifices at the feet of Melech, the bull king. That was no mystery. Everybody knew the ideas and their associations, but the people round about Jacob knew it with a sort of matter-of-fact respect, which was quite different from the sensitiveness of Jacob's spiritual tradition. He had nothing against a reasonable oracle, say, of the arrow, or by lot, to find out the favorable time for a business transaction, and he probably took note of the way birds flew or smoke blew at a sacrifice. But where God-given understanding went to pieces, and rank frenzy took its place, then began that which he called a foolishness, which was in his mouth a strong word, strong enough to express the extreme of disapproval. It was Canaan. It was all that which had to do with the sinister story of the grandfather in his tent, and who should go naked with his manhood bared, whoring after the bales of the land, exposing oneself, round-singing, intemperate feasting, official unchastity with the temple women, cult of Sheol, yes, and aula saula la kaula, and wild epileptic prophesyings. It all went together, it was all one, and it was a foolishness in Jacob's eyes. It tortured him to think that Joseph's childish tendency to roll his eyes and dream dreams could have any connection with this impure region of the soul. Jacob, too, as we know, was a dreamer, but in all honor. He had seen in his dream God the King and his angels, and to the surging music of the harps he had received from him the most heartening promises. But certainly such a lifting up of the head from affliction and outward humiliation was distinguished by reason, measure, and spiritual integrity from every sort of evil-working magic. Alas, that such honorable gifts and blessings of the fathers could dwindle down to elegant corruption in their unstable sons. It was charming to see the parent in the guise of the son, but alarming and suspect to see him dwindling down. At least there was consolation in the thought that Joseph was still so young. He would lose his instability, become more solid and robust, and ripen to sobriety and godlike understanding. But it did not escape Jacob's sharp eye that the lad's proneness to a suspicious kind of seizure had to do with nakedness, so with abandonment, so with Baal and Sheol, with death magic and under earthly unreason. And here, then, was the ground of Jacob's approving the influence of the man of letters upon his beloved son. It was good to have Joseph learn something, good that he practiced himself under informed guidance in the word and in the art of writing. He, Jacob, had not needed this. His wildest dreams had all been modest and honorable. But Joseph's, the old man felt, might need to be disciplined by application of reason and exactitude. Thus there might come a blessing to the steadying of his unstable youth, and then he would bear no resemblance at all to horned and naked vagrants and epileptics. So Jacob considered within himself. Certain dark elements in the composition of his beloved seemed to him to need release and clarification in the intellectual. Thus we see that he, in his considering way, came to Joseph's own boyish conclusion, that the awareness of the body must be corrected and justified by the awareness of the mind.